I'm Jonna Kaplan.
And I'm Carrie Provost, and you're listening to Going Steady,
a podcast about exploring places in the land of steady habits and beyond.
Welcome back to Going Steady. This time we are talking about a hidden river in Connecticut, what to wear in New England, and our favorite travel-related movies. We're going to start with something that Carrie knows a lot about, being a Hartford aficionado. And I know a little bit about having lived in Hartford for a while, but I suspect most people in Connecticut don't know about at all.
The Park River is in central Connecticut. Its watershed is in Bloomfield, West Hartford, Hartford, Newington, and Wethersfield. It's divided into North Branch, South Branch, segments 1 and 2 in the plain old Park River. Its tributaries include the following brooks: Trout, Piper, Mill, Cemetery, Beamans, Tumbledown, Wash, and Philly. The North Branch Park watershed spans 29 square miles, while the South Branch Park watershed spans nearly 40 square miles. The Park River itself, all branches, totals 11.3 miles in length. Bobcats, black bears, coyote, and other wildlife live around the river today. My interest in the river is pretty simple and straightforward. It's about a block from my home, sort of. Not really. I'll explain that later.
And that's the part that I think most people don't know, right? The sort of?
The sort of.
Can you explain what is strange about the Park River as far as comparing it to most rivers that people in Connecticut might go to walk along the river walk or something like that?
Parts of it are wild. Parts of it are in what looks like a concrete basin, and a part of it is buried underground. So it just sort of vanishes from sight if you're looking down at it from I-84. And then it doesn't really reemerge. It enters the Connecticut River.
That's what I was thinking that most people are not aware of, since I certainly was not until I moved to Hartford, that downtown Hartford used to have a river running through it, right?
Right through Bushnell Park.
So today, when you're walking in Bushnell Park and other parts of the city, you're walking above a river which has been buried underground and contained within a tunnel. You said the Park River, but this is sometimes called the Hog River.
Yep, it's had a lot of names. I found that in the 1840s, the Current put a lot of ink into whether or not the claim that this was called by the indigenous population, the Sikkim River, accurate. So there was a series of letters going back and forth into the newspaper, signed by not actual people's names, but like a description of them. So who knows how accurate any of these claims were. One person who wrote in basically said that if anyone knew what this term Sikkim meant, that they would blush by using it. So the suggestion was maybe that was not actually used by the indigenous. And then when the settlers arrived, they were calling the Connecticut River Big River, so Park River became Little River because they were pretty close to each other, so just that comparison. There are old maps of downtown Hartford that call at least the section of it downtown the Mill River because there were tanneries and mills on it. And then going back to like 1784, at least, that's where we start to see it being called Hog River in ink. And I couldn't find an exact reason why. There were some sale ads that mentioned a pasture right along the river, so it could have been pigs living right there. And, you know, the other explanation is that people since the beginning have been dumping their trash in it, so it had a stink.
Right, and that's what I think of when I think of Hog River is like, I recall that the river kind of had a bad reputation at one point, or people tried to say that it did in order to justify covering it up, but that like it was dirty and maybe pigs lived in it and maybe people were like pigs or something.
And they built the tenements right up on it along Sheldon Street. Yeah, there were reports of people throwing their ash cans. Basically, they'd burn their trash or sometimes not burn it, throw it out the windows into the river. But again, that was an area that was where a lot of immigrants lived.
Right.
And so we know like sometimes the reports might be exaggerated.
Right.
But it just wasn't individuals. Like as soon as our industry got going, the factories would be dumping all kinds of chemicals in. In the late 1800s, there were multiple newspaper reports of fish going crazy and having like riots in the river and like basically jumping around, thrashing around because they were dying from being poisoned from chemicals coming down from these factories, some of the big name factories that helped Hartford make its wealth that it did have at one time. Also, it wasn't just in Hartford. It was like out in New Britain and Newington got blamed as well. People, you know, factories dumping their waste into the tributaries. So I guess, you know, pick which explanation you want. The name changed again to Park River, which seems to have stuck because of the creation of Bushnell Park. Part of the reason that Horace Bushnell wanted a park was to try to clean up the river that was going through downtown.
And Bushnell Park would look very nice with a river running through it, as much as one can imagine that.
Right. There are postcards you can find that show what it looked like. And you can see some of the old bridge structures.
Did the Park River flood like the Connecticut seasonally?
Yeah, so there were reports about it overflowing its banks, like basically every spring. It's interesting because I've looked at different newspapers over the years, and I would say that the Current was much more all about reporting on these floods than the Hartford Times was, which I found very interesting, and I'm not, you know, I don't know the reason for that. I think the earliest report of the Hog River mention was actually in reference to somebody drowning in it, not necessarily because of a flood, but there were floods reported. It was just matter of fact for a very long time.
Was that sort of related to the way people started to see nature maybe in a different way, or cities in a different way?
I think so, because I'm going to talk about this later, but I think there was a particular moment where it seemed like, you know, mankind was able to conquer this pesky nature in a lot of ways. And we have the machines now, we can speed things up and look at all these amazing things we can do. And just kind of like, you know, steamrolled over everything, probably a little bit literally there, just because they could. And so these things that were a nuisance in the past suddenly became, we need to do something about that now.
In my mind, falls into the same category of the highways.
Right.
That cut Hartford in half, like so many of our cities. Like,
yeah,
we can build this huge thing.
Right. And not necessarily questioning whether it's needed or if we should. I'm going to get to that in a little bit.
So what did the river look like in the past?
If you're driving on I-84, which I think probably be the passenger when you're, you know, looking. If you're going eastbound on 84 towards Hartford and you start to see like the Trinity Chapel around there, you kind of look down and see the river and it looks very, very straight. And that's not how it was. It was that general area, but it's channelized right now. So basically it was put in a concrete basin. It was very windy. So the roads that you see now wouldn't have been able to be in those places with the way how windy it is and knowing that rivers do flood from time to time. So over time, people straightened segments of it for the ease of transportation and industry and real estate. So to clarify, the North Branch of the Park River, that's the segment that flows south from Bloomfield and ends in a conduit near Farmington Avenue, just behind an apartment building. This section of the river hasn't been tinkered with as much. There is the conduit there, and they did some work on it down there. It doesn't mean it's not polluted in some places, but it's pretty wild. Lots of trees on the bank, so it's not like it doesn't have the open vista of the Connecticut River. It, you know, it gets runoff from parking lots and athletic fields and so forth, but it's also home for bobcats. I saw one down that way, and we know that they live there. They get tracked. Black bears go through there. There was one that popped out from that area the other day to go and say hello to some kids over at the high school up along Mark Twain Drive. A lot of birds. It's really pretty. So there's actually another little conduit there where it's buried. So it basically stops to your view at Farmington Avenue. And then there, if you're on Farmington Avenue and you look next to the Mark Twain house, there's this big wide open field and that had a river going through it. You can't see any of it again until you get to Pope Park. So just south of Park Street. From there, it's in this concrete basin, and that part is the South Branch, and that's where it's been very manipulated. Basically is devoid of nature and life. It's above ground, but it's a basin. And that goes on for, I want to say, a mile. And then it actually, they stopped channelizing it in the area of Brookfield and Flatbush, roughly. They put in a restored wetlands area recently. And then on the other side of Flatbush and Hartford, where there's the Walmart Plaza, Brookfield down to Newfield, it becomes more natural again. And then, of course, there was the other part that had been underground, and that completely covered between Pope Park and downtown. So there's like two different main sections that were covered. And this is very confusing. So I'll put up a picture or something in the show notes so that you can see this. But from Pope Park to downtown, the river kind of curved around. There's the old Bradley's Plaza, we'll just call it that. It's Bradley's hasn't been there for years, but it went behind that building through this wooded Bankside Grove area and around a bunch of factory buildings, kind of zigging and zagging around where the state capitol is now and like the edge of Bushnell Park. So you'll see there's this giant, I don't know, what I'll call it, retaining wall by the train tracks and kind of over in that general area, and it swooped out towards Pearl Street.
In the past, when people lived right by this river, other than Mark Twain, who presumably just appreciated its beauty, and maybe other people living in the West End, downtown, do people use it for like water?
So I think people were drinking out of it at some point, but you know, people were putting mills in it. They were damming it for industry and all of that. There was some transportation in it, like boats for transportation, but only up to, I'd say like the Bushnell Park area from the Connecticut River, because it's a lot more shallow after that point. There was a whole decision based on, is it a navigable river or not? But people fished in it for a long time. I think today, if I saw somebody fishing in it, I would probably try to intervene and let them know, not a great idea. But kids could swim in it and play in it, and they did. In the Bushnell Park area and also south of there, kids swimming in the river and playing around it basically stopped when people stopped free-range parenting as the norm. So, you know, you give people an open body of water, people drown in it over time. And that sounds very flippant, but you know, that's year after year, there were reports of that for various reasons, sometimes adults, sometimes kids. Sometimes it was like the spring floods and people just underestimated how much power the river had. Other times kids just playing and didn't know how to swim and fell in. In the 60s, there were a couple of high profile drownings very close together. There was some public outcry, and there were actually people who were petitioning to have the Park River like filled in, covered over from Pope Park all the way down through like basically the end of town. They just wanted to get rid of the river. And thankfully, it was deemed too expensive to do that. They did put up fencing. Eventually, they lowered water levels a little bit in that section. So now it's really rare to see anybody in it or around it. There's graffiti in some places, so we know people do hang out there, but I've never seen kids playing in it.
So it was buried. Part of it was buried before the 60s, right? Before this discussion.
Right, yeah. So you wanted to know like when it was buried and why.
Yeah, like when
did they... It's complicated.
Right.
They have manipulated that river since the beginning of time in one way or another, or at least the beginning of the settlers coming in. So there have been smaller attempts to, you know, manipulate and to straighten pieces of it. And, you know, as we're saying, like housing and transportation and all of that, engineers love straight lines, right? And it's hard to have a straight line with a river unless you're planning to build a lot of bridges over that river. So this didn't happen all at once. The first segment that was placed in a conduit was from Bushnell Park to the Connecticut River. The planning for that began in 1938, like basically right after the big flood. If you've ever traveled on the Whitehead Highway, which is a little spur to get you to 91, you drive over its path. And if you've been in the Hartford Public Library, the main branch, you've been over it because the library is built over a highway, which is built over the river.
And that's quite funny because clearly if you've been on the Whitehead Highway or that whole little area, burying this river did not make the streets more navigable or more straight or more grid-like in any way.
No. And in that... I mean, it's funny because in the talk up to doing that, they had for years, you know, as I was saying, like Sheldon Street, you had tenements where people were accused of being pigs, basically. They weren't calling it slum clearance at the time, but there were pushes to basically do that. So I think that sometimes there were some opportunistic things going on, like if a big storm wiped out a bunch of housing, they said, okay, we're not going to rebuild that. So in the 1960s, Much of the river from Bushnell Park to just south of Park Street and Pope Park was placed into conduit and buried, but not all of it. And I haven't figured out why yet, why some sections were left open, but they were. You know, they were pushing for that, you know, around the 1955, I want to say, but they didn't have the urgency. So I couldn't figure out what that was about. This is also the time when they buried the part from Laurel Street to Farmington Avenue. So that North Branch part, the little piece that's like playing fields now.
So it's so interesting because, again, I think, like I said at the top, it's a hidden river. And I think even though there are some places where it pops up, it is really mostly hidden, as opposed to obviously the Connecticut River, which really is an asset to downtown Hartford.
Right. In the 70s, there were plans, late 70s, there were plans for the last pieces. And that was, in reading the old newspaper articles, it didn't seem like there was anything to do with flooding at all for that last section. But that was also when they were doing an auxiliary conduit. So it wasn't enough to cover it. And then they dug up Park Street to pop another pipe down that. So the why. So the commonly believed story is that the Park River had to be buried because of the flooding. And the river flooded since forever. We see all these newspaper accounts. But there was no real strong push, no rhetoric about we really need to do something to prevent flooding until 1935. So here, seeing things since the 1700s saying it floods, and more or less being like annoyed but accepting. And then 1935, we have to do something.
Before the Great Flood, ironically.
Right. And so not really any urgency there. And there were, and I'll get to this in a second, but there were calls to bury the river before that time, just not for flooding. So Cemetery Brook, it's one of the tributaries, was also mostly stuffed underground. So it's not just this river, there's other pieces of it. This one is another example of there were no complaints about flooding until people began to build homes in large numbers around the brook. And there are all these photographs I found of people who built garages over the brook or like right up literally on the bank. And I'm going, well, I don't have that kind of sympathy for you. You see that what's here and you built right over it. So I'm thinking of that on the larger scale. Yeah, people were building in this area at higher numbers. And so you're going to have more people who are upset about things, right? So no serious planning was agreed to until after the 1938 flood. And then I believe it only really anything happened because federal relief money came through. So that another major flood happened in 1955. There was a little bit more advocating for coverage that happened, and that wasn't given the same speed or attention. So the second burial happened in the 60s, just as Interstate 84 was being built through Hartford. And there was some collaboration with the highway department on that. And you'll see, you know, interestingly, what basically follows the river and how there were so many potential plans for 84 that could have taken different routes, and that was the one that was chosen. And then the final covering really didn't seem to have anything to do with flooding. As far as I could see, there was an article, not an op-ed or a letter, but an actual article in The Current that applauded the gain in land that could be used for parking in parks and had like this title of like the ugly Park River finally out of sight, like something along those lines. I was like, wow, you're not even a letter to the editor. So when I say this was not simply about flooding, it's because, you know, doing some research and finding like in 1911, the Hartford Current ran an article with detailed possible plans to cover the Park River from the Connecticut River to Hamilton Street. And they said, aside from hiding the river from view, an advantage would be the gain in territory for building and highway purposes. The plan to cover this portion of the river was rejected because of the cost, along with what they called unhealthful conditions that would arise from gases and possible damage from excessive floods. So they wanted to cover it, but they were afraid that flooding would ruin it, ironically. And then in 1926, Herbert S. Swan, who was a New York-based city planner doing some consulting for the city of Hartford and then East Hartford, Weathersfield, and some other suburbs in Connecticut, he produced a plan that doesn't seem to have been completely adopted, but it was, let's see, he claimed that glacial erosion laid the foundation for Hartford's traffic problems. So he was the first to actually start posing that Hartford had a traffic problem, which by today would be completely laughable if you look at the traffic counts and things. You're like, are you kidding me? That's like a Sunday morning when everyone's sleeping in. At this time, he's seeing parks and cemeteries as a handicap for Hartford traffic. So that gives you some perspective into what his priorities are. He calls the Park River an obstruction to communication between the north and south parts of the city, talking about how there have been complaints about its appearance. And he talks about how in 1923, the mayor had talked about the appearance of the Park River and had said we should cover portions of this downtown, and mostly to have wider thoroughfares, 75 feet wide streets on the roof of this conduit. Took me 4 pages into the segment on the Park River in this booklet that he produced before he raised flooding as a concern at all. And the way it was talked about was how to build a conduit to accommodate floods. So again, and that's 1926. And then skip ahead, only 1935 is where we start to see the current call to bury the Park River. But first for beautification, and then secondary to prevent flooding of cellars on Asylum Street and on Jewel Street. So flooding cellars doesn't even seem, I mean, if it's your house, it's a big deal, but not a big, big deal overall. It's not convincing that it's purely done to prevent floods. It seems like, you know, they had been laying the groundwork for this for some time, and perhaps flooding was what got them the money to have this happen. And of course, you know, by today's standards, it's not the way of treating a flood situation.
Certainly not the cheapest way.
Yeah. Historian Wilson Foudy. Yeah. In 2006, he wrote this little thing that I have to share. He said, under the guise of flood control, the city received approval of the plan to bury the Park River. When the mountains of dirt created by the project obscured all views of the park, that's Bushnell Park, the city park took park land and Park River bed and built streets in their place. It happened without the public notice or objection. The bridge beneath the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Arch was shortened by over 60 feet. The multi-span Hoadley Bridge was reduced to a plaque. The single-lane road that once bordered the park on its north and east side, Ford, Jewel, and Wells Streets, was widened to 6 lanes, in part with islands in the middle. At the railroad bridge on Asylum, more land was taken to form a multi-lane thoroughfare complete with bus pull-offs. In other words, he wrote, the Park River was never the problem, but by burying it, the city could solve its road issues.
So a lot of different parties with different reasons to want to bury this and a lot of different justifications.
Yeah, very shady. And in short, I think if people want to believe this was all done for flooding, as I've had people turn to me even after reading some things I've written about it, and they're like, well, it was because of the floods. Like, I'm not going to argue with you. Believe what you want. Generally, it seems to be a trend nationwide that rivers had been buried in various cities in part or in whole to keep people from throwing their trash in and so that they could build things on top.
And we are going to talk about another buried river in a little bit.
Yeah.
So I want to know about the tours. Where people can see this river or how they can experience it today.
Right.
As sort of a curiosity in a way, because it's a river running underneath the capital city.
Yeah. So first, the North Branch part, which has not been that much tinkered with. To my knowledge, there are no formal tours of that part of the river or the others, but I know sometimes some groups will organize little walks along there above ground. The North Branch paths tend to be overgrown. So if you're going to do that, I would suggest fall, winter, spring when it's not overrun with poison ivy. There's no reason not to go there by yourself or with a friend. The paths are a little bit neglected, so you might have to hack a path. There are paths along part of the South Branch above ground, and the easiest way to get to those would be to enter either from Brookfield and Flatbush in Hartford or by Brookfield and Margarita Drives. They're doing a little bit of construction on the path currently. There are dirt paths beyond the paved section. So if you're not afraid to get a little bit muddy, you can kind of go from Flatbush down to Newfield. And it's pretty interesting. That's a fairly natural section. And I've done those parts by myself with other people, and it's pretty straightforward. East of Flatbush, where it's not channelized for a little bit, it's a wetland restoration area where if you enter from that side at Flatbush, you can see a sign that says don't go there. But if you happen to enter in another way, you can end up in it and not have seen any sign saying you weren't supposed to be there. So just be aware you're not supposed to be there because you'll disrupt nesting birds or something. And there aren't really clear paths there anyway. And then after that, you hit this channelized segment. So I guess as a novelty, it could be interesting to walk along it, but it gets a little dull fast.
It's not much to see in that part.
So it's at a little bit of an angle. It's harder, you know, it's not impossible. I'd say like maybe moderate degree of, effort you might put in. You can see where there's polluted runoff entering the Park River through a bunch of little things that you'd have to step over. So that's exciting. But that section is very degraded, so there's not going to be a lot of wildlife or anything to look at. But the part that I know you're really curious about, it's in the vicinity of Pope Park. So It's between Hamilton and Park Streets where you would be able to enter. I don't see any signs that say you can't be there, but there is some fencing around parts of it. You can walk down into the conduit. And by the way, it's in Pope Park. So it's on park or in parklands. At one time, there had been professional tours that everyone talks about. It was like Huck Finn something. And as far as I understand, they either couldn't get insurance or their insurance got dropped for these tours. So there are no professional organized tours I know of. With that said, I know of people who have gone down there in groups, just like friends going down there. I know probably a dozen or more people who have over the years gone through in a raft or kayak or something. So I know it can be done. I don't know what the legality is of that. There are videos on the internet that you could see to get an idea of it. I haven't personally done this because it seems very claustrophobic to me. And
yeah, it's not something that I would want to do personally, but knowing that it's been done in the past, I think that's something that people might be curious about, even if they don't actually go in a kayak, but just to stand and kind of look, peer into the tunnel and see the river.
Yeah. So I have done lower stress version where walking, there's a little bit of a ledge and you can walk in for a little bit. It gets dark. And at some point, I decided I was far enough and I turned around and it gets very, very dark when it gets dark because there's nothing, it's not like they have lights on in the tunnel. It's like stale air. It smells like where you are. I saw a dead fish float by. It's stagnant. The only signs of life were teeny tiny gnats. It's not especially pleasant, but it's kind of interesting to temporarily be under the city. So I can't comment on how legal the activity is. But if you're someone who's worried about trespassing, I think the real danger there is if you're in a boat or something and you're halfway under the city and you have some sort of medical condition like a heart attack. One, I wouldn't bank on your cell phone working. And two, good luck trying to explain to the dispatcher where you are.
Okay, that sounds terrifying.
And someone else brought that up, but it was scolding me for thinking about doing this. And I was like, I already thought about that. Trust me. There's a reason I haven't done it.
Yeah. So definitely enter at your own risk in every way.
Yes. What I've heard from people who have gone, they've advised multiple headlamps be used, life jackets, obviously. I would look at maps and not like Google Maps, but any maps that have been used by engineers for like where the conduit tunnels go, and that there's one where there's apparently some drop off.
It's basically spelunking.
Yeah, I'm not advising that people do this necessarily, but if you're going to do it, be smart about it, and I'm not responsible for you.
That disclaimer said, is there currently any movement to either uncover the river or clean up the river or use it in some way as an attraction in its current state?
The Park River watershed has done some nice work bringing attention to water quality and cleaning up parts of the river, but that focus really is on the North Branch for what they do. Overall, I wouldn't say there's an active push. There have been a number of people over the years who have promoted something being done, and I would say pretty much since it was finished getting buried in the 80s, people have been wanting to reconnect to it. And there have been pushes for trails alongside, if nothing else. If not, before they were talking about daylighting, they were talking about, well, let's have some nature trails. And we're only starting to see some of those coming to light. The daylighting, which is the fancy term that urbanists use for unearthing, unburying parts of a river there was a push about 10 years ago from the IQIL people in Hartford, but it didn't get a lot of traction for a few reasons. And I think because initially it sounded really good, but then they're saying, well, we can't pay for all of that, but what would we maybe be able to fund? It would have been kind of a channel, like another concrete channel type thing through Bushnell Park where they took Gully Brook. They're going to take that water and like do something. And it sounded like it was going to look like a storm gutter or something. It didn't sound, a lot of people didn't find this very appealing and it would be really expensive. So far, not so much. And especially with our finances.
Because obviously this would be a huge and very expensive undertaking. The corollary to this would be the Providence River.
Yeah.
In Providence, which was daylighted.
Yes. Yeah.
new vocabulary word in the 90s. And today it's pretty much impossible, at least for me, to even imagine downtown Providence without those rivers. It's such a centerpiece and such an asset of that city.
Right. So I wouldn't call it hopeless. And that is the trend overall is, and there's all kinds of articles about this, like the trend is to daylight these rivers around the world. Providence, right, they uncovered the river. That was one of the legacies of Buddy CNC.
The uncovering of it was part of a much larger project downtown. They actually moved the river several hundred feet, and they moved the Amtrak station into another building, and they built a lot of offices, or I don't even remember what type of buildings down there. It was like not only the river, it was a whole revamping of downtown.
People have come to this understanding that, you know, channelizing or burying rivers creates these dead zones, like bio dead zones and social and cultural dead zones. And I think Providence realized that, and Hartford lags behind other cities in a lot of ways. There are things that we do well, but when it comes to making large progressive changes, we stumble over. And part of it is a money issue. But, you know, a few years ago, they decided, let's build a minor league stadium with public money. And I love baseball, but given the choice, I'd say let's put some money into like doing something to, you know, revamp our natural environment.
Yeah, it's the downside of the steady habits.
Uh-huh.
Just takes forever. And I don't even know at this point whether, I'm sure there are debates about this, whether any kind of improvements to the Park River is what Hartford needs the most. I mean, I'm sure there are many other, even iQuilt has been working so long to sort of connect a rather small part of the city through walkways.
Personally, I don't think it needs to be this all or nothing. So the engineers built these things to not be removed. So that's part of the problem, is that they are in place. It doesn't mean that they can't be removed, but that it's very difficult, which means it costs a lot of money to get them changed. But I think that there are other things we can do. Like there, that horrible part that you can see from I-84, that's like the straight line of concrete. You know, you can get creative about bringing some nature back there. Even if you can't necessarily remove the concrete, you can put stuff on top of it. I think it is encouraging that all over there has been this change of heart that engineers have said, you know, first of all, we don't deal with floods that way anymore. We have better technology. We know that climate change is happening and that there are ways to mitigate that through like local changes. So there are a lot of reasons, not just aesthetic. So this is like a block from my home. It's buried about a block from my home. There are a lot of people who are cut off from this urban river. And that's, you know, that has happened other places as well, but also these other places have figured out how to take the rivers back. All right, so we have a warm, sunny day on this beautiful Memorial Day weekend, but we're in New England, so who knew what it was going to be like this morning?
And who knows what will happen next week?
Right.
So we wanted to talk about something kind of light and fun, but also extremely stressful. Dressing for New England weather and packing for a New England vacation.
What have you figured out how to do?
So I struggle with this on a daily basis, so I'm not an expert, but I think I've learned over the years a whole bunch of tips. So first of all, seasons. We have all of them. Sometimes we have most of them in one day. So it's very important if you're traveling here to dress seasonally, appropriately. Layers are good any time of year. In spring and summer, I like to have a lightweight sweater or scarf that can easily be folded up and stuck in my bag. So if you're on an Amtrak train, which gets freezing, or inside air conditioning, you could pull it out. When you're outside in the sun, you might take it off. In winter, you know, just all the accessories, hat, gloves, scarf, good socks, good boots, sunglasses. Something that always throws me a little bit is how in some other places, sunglasses are seen as a summer only accessory. Whereas here, I think winter is just as bright and sunny if it's not actively snowing. And the glare off the snow can really hurt your eyes. So you definitely need sunglasses in winter too. Spring in New England is cold for the most part. This is something that I think is interesting in recent years as the whole preppy, and I put preppy in quotes because it's not like the old-fashioned New England prep, but it's like this newer kind of blogger preppy that's actually much girlier and less practical than like the traditional prep. this like New England look is really popular right now on social media and in the kind of influencer world. And so I think those people are doing a lot of advertising for tourist attractions and therefore hopefully spreading a lot of tourism to the region. But I think they also might make you think that if you come here in the springtime, you can wear a little cotton dress and espadrilles and have a picnic at the beach, and you can't. You will freeze to death. So just, you know, like anywhere, check the weather, especially check for the chance of rain, because there's a good chance it will rain in any season, and having a little portable umbrella is always a good bet. Having a water-resistant bag so that your camera and your phone and all that will stay dry inside your bag as you're walking around. Footwear is super important, especially if you're doing anything outdoorsy.
And we talk about footwear. This has been the hard transition for me. I've realized I've gotten not more politically conservative as I've gotten older, but I've gotten much more reasonable about what I will wear. And that's been hard because I will wear some ugly shoes. Blisters are just not worth it.
And the ground can be, trails here can be very rocky, lots of tree roots, lots of rough terrain that maybe people wouldn't expect, since it's not, you know, the vast kind of national parks and western terrain. It's not mountains, well, little tiny mountains, but it's not, but really it can be quite difficult. And even like just a normal, more of a boardwalk or a path can get slippery if it's wet, you know. And I hike in flip-flops, so like I'm not, you know, perfect about this. You're right when you said conservative. Like New Englanders are pretty conservative in dress and practical. You don't necessarily have to wear ugly shoes. You can find cute, practical, sturdy shoes, but that's important. Even in Boston, which is probably the city in New England where people would be the most, not dressy, but the most comparable to another city like New York, the fashion is still a lot less risky. The footwear is a lot more tame. You can wear whatever you want here, honestly. People will not bother you. But if you want to be comfortable, and especially if you want to not stand out, you know, we're pretty casual.
If you know that you are going to be walking on a cute cobblestone street, maybe don't wear your stilettos.
Especially if you didn't grow up here or somewhere. If you didn't grow up somewhere where you did get used to walking in heels on cobblestones, don't start now.
If I'm just doing a day trip around, one pair of shoes is enough. But if I'm going for more than a couple of days and I'm going to be outdoors a lot, I'm probably bringing an extra pair of shoes of some kind.
Oh yeah.
So if it gets rained, I get rained on. I'm not stuck with one soggy pair of sneakers.
I will also sometimes just have flip-flops in the car in case of blisters or whatever.
Like nothing, not a big deal, just like something extra so you don't have to ever make that choice of going barefoot.
If you are traveling by car, you have that option of having an extra pair of shoes or an extra jacket. Mm-hmm. I always joke about how if you go to, you know, your mom's house for the weekend in Connecticut, you need to bring 3 jackets. It's ridiculous, but it's true. So if you're traveling without a car, you can't bring as much, but some light, if it's summer, some little flip-flops like in your tote bag.
If you are a fashion blogger, I don't know, something I've been doing more of, and I'm not a fashion blogger, but I take a lot of pictures, and I don't necessarily like wearing pants all the time, but I'm doing a lot of like leggings under skirts so I can crouch and not flash everybody.
I am a huge fan of dresses in summer. It's just so much easier. I would wear dresses in winter if I could pull it off, but somehow it's just difficult. In winter, I actually wear, they're not flattering at all, but I find wearing tighter pants so that they can fit into your boots, whether it's rain boots in spring or snow boots in winter, it just makes it more comfortable. Otherwise, you get the pants colliding with the snow and you get the bottom 6 inches of your pants are just sopping wet, and it's not fun. And one thing that we also should mention is how diverse the weather can be within New England. So it doesn't take too long to get from Connecticut to Maine relative to other regions, but Maine in the summer is pretty cool. You definitely are not going to want to just wear a tank top. So the one other thing I would say, which might not matter to you, but going along with the conservative theme, in New England, people don't really do so much of the big hair and the big makeup. You don't need to fit in anywhere if you don't want to. But if you do want to, you know, if you want to do the kind of travel where you're kind of blending in, yeah, toned down and casual all the way, which is a little bit sad. I had to, when I moved back here from New York, I kind of abandoned half my wardrobe, and I was not a crazy dresser by any means, but it's just, it's very casual. Unless you're coming here to attend some kind of gala, then it's different, of course.
Yes, if or it's a wedding, giant fashion influencers blogger gala
convention. I don't think we have those around here.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, and wear sunscreen.
Yeah, sunscreen.
It's deceptive, and I get burned a lot all the time because I forget to do it.
And sunscreen on your feet if you're wearing sandals. Ask me how I know. From being out and about and properly dressed to staying in and watching movies, we talked about a couple episodes ago our favorite travel books. So this time we thought we would do our top five travel related films. So we're just gonna like go back and forth, and we don't know what each other has picked.
No, we have not talked about this. And I was very self-conscious making this list because I have a lot of lowbrow trashy stuff on my list.
So what I'm going to say is my number one is Trax. Do you have that one?
No.
I thought you might have that one.
No.
Okay. So it might be sort of a cliche, but it is sort of your classic woman traveling alone movie. And I love it. It's based on a book, which is based on a true story, a true event, by a young woman who walked across Australia, or across a good chunk of Australia. I don't remember exactly the journey, but very remote, unpopulated areas, and accompanied by only a dog and some camels. And she did have some kind of outside help, which is not really the main point of it, but it's essentially kind of a story of a woman doing whatever the fuck she wants. I'm going to swear in this segment. And just really captures that feeling of traveling alone, especially in kind of isolated areas, and like the highs and lows. And it's visually amazing. I usually am more of a person to read a book and not see the movie, but this one I did backwards, and I kind of have no desire to read the book now because I feel like with the Australian outback, it just works so well in a visual medium. It's just a gorgeous movie, and it will really inspire you to travel and possibly to cut your hair too.
I hadn't even heard of that, so that's
definitely
added.
Watch that. Yeah. This is one of those, like, if you liked Wild or if you didn't much like Wild, you will love Trax because it's sort of the same genre, but like a million times better in my humble opinion.
I'll start with the one that makes me sound smart. Baraka. So they play this every year at Cine Studio in Hartford, and you can find it. It's pretty old at this point. There's no dialogue in the movie. There's sound, but no dialogue. So there's chanting, singing. I don't want to call it a photo montage. That's not really what it is. I wouldn't say that there's any plot to it. You're seeing a lot of different representations of people's cultures and religions, and you see jungle, and it just takes you all over the world. So it's really pretty. It's totally worth seeing at least once.
That sounds really cool. I'd heard of it, but I didn't know that that's what it was. So I'm excited now. So my second is Gadio Dilo, which is sometimes called The Crazy Stranger, which I guess was its English release translation. And it's also referred to as a comedy, weirdly, because it's not at all comic. The main character, who's this young French guy, is kind of a goofball, and he is thrown into a very different culture and at times sort of treated like an object of fun by these other people. So maybe that's why they call it a comedy. But if you're looking for a comedy, I would not see it. But it's just one of my favorite movies overall. And basically, he is going to Romania to track down these... he's researching a singer, a Roma singer. And he has these recordings, and he goes to this little Roma village, and the people there tell him they can help him with his research. So he ends up kind of living with them for quite a while and being fully immersed into their culture. And the director is fully or partly ethnically Romani. So I just love the way that a small and often really misunderstood group of people is depicted in this movie. It's just, they're not idealized. They're just presented without apology. And I love it. And I also really love the main female character in this, both the character and the actress, just something you don't often see in film. She's another kind of do whatever you want type of character. And of course they fall in love, and it's just an interesting story. And at the end, he really learns something. There's an understanding that kind of profoundly shifts him and his little mission there after some experiences that they go through that are not comedic in any way, but really kind of beautiful movie and unusual.
So Amélie is on my list, and I'm realizing I hadn't seen it so long, and I want to call it a French film, and I'm thinking, well, were there subtitles or not? And I can't remember, but I think I'm safe to say it's in French.
Yeah, there were subtitles.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I like, you know, she is quirky, and she just kind of explores her city and knows people who aren't very adventurous. So she has the whole I kidnapped your gnome and pictures that you know, send back, right?
So that part,
but just the idea of like making the most of where you are. So exploration in another way. And I'll say a film that I dropped off my list, but I'm thinking of at the same time as this, is French Kiss, which has Meg Ryan in it. So that should tell you why. I was like, no, don't put that in your top five. I don't normally like romantic comedies or those with Meg Ryan. And I'm not even sure why I have this film. So it ended up in my possession somehow. It starts with her in this like therapy session so that she can get over her fear of flying. And, you know, then she goes and she cancels a trip. But then, you know, the boyfriend, the fiance is off messing around on her in France. So she gets up her nerve and she goes on this flight. And then the wacky hijinks ensue of her, you know, meeting some scoundrel who, you know, and she gets all of her stuff stolen and her passport. And then she goes and she's basically a very buttoned up person. And she kind of learns how to like let loose a little bit and even eat cheese and have a dairy reaction on a train. And so, and you see a lot of pretty, like, you know, France countryside sort of stuff. But I love the story of like someone's got their life a little too perfect and it starts to crumble. I don't know why, but I love that kind of movie or TV show. So even though I look at it, I'm like, I still cringe because it's something that I'm embarrassed to have in my house. So that's not in my top list, but I had to mention it.
It's like a little runner-up category.
Yeah.
There. All right. So my third is Trans-Siberian, which is a genre, I guess, that I don't normally... Well, it's sort of an action movie, which I do sometimes like, but it's also sort of like a crime thriller kind of thing, which I don't typically like. But for some reason, maybe because it's all very travel-y, it just kind of works for me. It's about this American couple who take a train from China to Russia. And there are lots of gorgeous shots of the train going through this stunning, snowy Siberian wilderness. And they kind of fall in with this other couple who, you know, may or may not be up to no good. And the woman in that pair is Kate Mara, who's also really badass. There's a lot of good acting. Ben Kingsley is in it playing a Russian and, you know, doing it, as far as I can tell, quite convincingly. But it's always in motion, and it really gets at that sort of uncertainty of travel and of new people and just making connections in terms of transportation and even getting to know the people that you're with in a different way. And it does have like a sort of very suspenseful chase element to it as well. But it's visually kind of gives you an image of Russia in a time and place that's visually interesting. I like a lot of movies set in really cold places, even though I don't like to be in really cold places.
I have Roman Holiday on my list, so a classic Audrey Hepburn, you know, royalty who decides she can't really handle her duties and goes on a tear. That's the last of my more decent movie choices, I would say, for the top tier. So Baraka, Amélie, and Roman Holiday are the ones I'm proud of.
Okay. Little cliffhanger. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so my last two are actually documentaries. My number four, I guess, is Horatio's Drive, America's First Road Trip, which is a Ken Burns documentary that aired on PBS quite a while ago. And it's about the first trip across the U.S. in an automobile, which happened in 1903. It's about this guy, Horatio Nelson Jackson, who drove on a bet with very little preparation from San Francisco to New York. And this was before there were many roads at all, certainly not many paved roads. It's kind of just a little feel-good documentary about 1903 America. It uses a lot of great old photos of everyday life because it's Ken Burns. And I actually just rewatched it because I hadn't seen it in a while and I thought maybe I would find it cheesy, but I didn't. I loved it. It's just really fun. It's like if you're in a bad mood, it's something you can watch. But it's also quite relevant to today. There's like themes of kind of people wanting to get famous and sponsored travel and American tourism, because this was like the start of the whole American road trip and a new type of American mobility. It's also a snapshot of just how the country was before it changed in a major way. But it's also not that different. Like if you've gone on a road trip and gone through some really small towns, it's not quite as different as it might seem.
And how did they manage without GPS?
Partly they followed the train tracks when they could. Other than that, they just kind of asked a lot of directions. There was one, actually, I'll tell an anecdote for it so you'll see like what kind of stuff is in this movie. At one point, they get hopelessly lost and they ask a young woman, which way is the next town? So she tells them all the way down this dirt track, and they go all the way down this dirt track and it's a dead end and there's nothing there but a farmhouse. And the people come out and they look at the car, because everywhere they go, people run out to like stare at the car. They've just never seen anything like it. So they know they went the wrong way. So they turn around and go back. And as they go back, they encounter the woman again. And they said, "Why did you tell us to go down there? There's nothing down there." And she's like, "I know. I just wanted my family to see you."
And knowing full well that he was going to have to pass her on the way out.
Yeah, probably.
So my last two are actually five. So it's two, but like series of movies. Indiana Jones. But to clarify, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom, and Last Crusade. Not that horror show, Crystal Skull nonsense or whatever that was. So it's goofy, but it's Harrison Ford. So give me a break. But I love that he's just like, I'm going to go have these adventures on planes that suddenly lose a pilot and fighting Nazis and everything else. But you're seeing trying to, you know, blend in different parts of the world. And it's totally unrealistic. But I've loved it since I was little, especially the parts where they show you the like fake map as he's flying. And you see like the plane sort of, you know, flying along this map to show you where they're going. So I stand by it, even though I know that there's probably some really problematic representations of different cultures by our standards now. I like the spirit of adventure.
And speaking of adventure, my last one is actually two series, Long Way Down / Long Way Round, which is a documentary series by Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman, who's also an actor. And basically, the first one, they drive around the world on motorcycles from London to New York going east. And then the second one, they go from Scotland to South Africa, so long way down. It's basically just documenting their trip. A lot of it is about motorcycles, but you don't have to be like into motorcycles to care about it. I'm not at all into motorcycles, but the motorcycles and their problems kind of stand in for all the problems you'd have in any mode of travel. And these were filmed in the early to mid 2000s. And already you can see how much has changed. Just, it's kind of makes me nostalgic. The first two episodes of, I think both of them, are just about their prep. Like all the maps that they go buy and all the gear that they need to get and all the passport issues. And today that would be done in like 10 minutes. They really take their time to tell the story. They go through, in both series, they go through so many countries and just meet so many people. And I think a lot of the countries that they visit, like places like Kazakhstan and different countries in Africa, probably have changed so much from the early 2000s to today that even that is like documenting like a moment in time. And I'm not sure that they thought of that at the moment, they just wanted to ride their motorcycles and see the world, you know? And it's also kind of a good depiction of like traveling to follow your own obsession, which for them was motorcycles. But, you know, for me, it would be history or something else. But yeah, they're just really enthusiastic and they get a bit much personality-wise at times because they're actors. And as a former actor, I know it like it can get a bit much. But they're generally really entertaining and it's funny and just kind of sweet and really inspiring. Inspires you to want to travel.
So my last one is National Lampoon's Vacation and European Vacation. So again, a sucker for anything that's like they're gonna go on vacation and then everything goes wrong. So if you're somehow not familiar with these movies, which I found out some people have not seen any of them, but it's Chevy Chase and then whatever rotating, you know, the cast is playing wife and daughters and sons and stuff at that time. But the Vacation one, basically, you know, they are going to Wally World, which is clearly like a Disneyland kind of place. And this is like an aspiring middle class family that this is not an easy, we'll just reschedule our trip or, you know, it's no big deal to them. Like, you know, it's you can feel for the family that has made some sacrifices to do this, and they're going to have a old-fashioned family cross-country trip, and they get there and it's closed. And so of course, you know, and there's stuff that happens along the way, but I love that. And it's so typical of so many things I've run into in my life that like I have so many situations where I'm like, this is Wally World. Do we break in to ride the roller coaster or turn around and come back? And then the European Vacation one, they go on some sort of game show, win a trip to Europe. Again, the same like aspiring middle class family. So this is going to be probably their only chance they will have to go to Europe. And they are lodgings leave a lot to be desired. And they are kind of terrible, typical tourists. They get chased out of at least one place for bad behavior. And of course, it has like the happy ending and everything like that. And it's kind of cheesy. I don't know. Something about it has stuck with me for a long time.
If you have favorite travel movies, let us know and leave a comment on our website under this, under the show notes to this episode. And of course, we'll link everything that we talked about today in the show notes as well.
There are a few Patreon supporters who we would like to thank. Allison, Anthony, Benjamin, Brian, Constanza, HS, Margot Lynn, Mary, Matthew, Nancy, and Steve.
Your support helps Going Steady keep going steady. Thank you.
You can now listen on the Apple Podcasts app, iTunes, and Stitcher. If you'd like to rate or review us over there, that would be a great help. You can also subscribe to Going Steady and receive notifications by email. Sign up at goingsteadyct.com. That's goingsteadyct.com. Comments, suggestions for future episodes, hit us up at goingsteadyct.com. ¶¶